Good evening. In this episode of News Wrap, context on the major news stories, as always, of the past week. This time, more chaos around the MK party. South Africa's homegrown swimming sensation, Tatiana Smith. Neil De Beers list of the 10 most wanted. Dean McPherson is attacking the construction mafia. And there's a new tipping system that's driving Americans crazy. I had personal experience of it last month. But first, let's recap on the latest news headlines. In the news headlines, we have details in this episode on the two big political stories of the week. MK founder Jabulani Khumalo's disclosures of alleged fraud by the Zuma family. And the departure by EFF co-founder Floyd Shivambu for the MK party. In another important development, however, peace may be breaking out between former allies turned foes, the Democratic Alliance and Freedom Front Plus. DA leader John Steenhuisen and Freedom Front Plus leader Dr. Pieter Groenewald met this week to discuss stabilizing governing coalitions in Western Cape municipalities. They pledged to work together to ensure stable governance and service delivery. Sasol's full-year results ending June 2024 highlighted a 50 billion rand bottom line reverse into deep losses, mainly due to write-offs in the controversial Lake Charles project in Louisiana. The final dividend was passed based on new criteria. Shareholders will receive no payout unless the net debt is below $4 billion. And at year end, Sasol's net debt was $4.1 billion. The company ascribed the decline in earnings to lower oil and chemical prices, as well as operational challenges. Despite this, Sasol maintained a strong balance sheet and announced plans to focus on cost-saving measures and advancing its transition to sustainable energy sources. The poor numbers had been discounted in the Sasol share price, which actually rose 3% in the days following the release of results. Watch out for our interview with Sasol's new CEO, Simon Baloyi, on Monday. Once known as the Roodepoort rocket because of its high leverage to the gold price, DRD Gold is nowadays as steady as she goes kind of stock, with the share price up just 1% in the past year despite a 16% rise in the rand price of gold. This week, the company reported a 13.5% increase in its revenue, that's to just over 6.25 billion rand, for the year to end June. Production fell 5% to 5,000 kilograms. All-in costs at DRD rose 15% to around 950,000 rand a kilogram, but that's still comfortably below the average gold price of 1.25 million rand per kilogram nowadays. Absa's board announced that Ari Rotenbach, who's 55, will be taking early retirement after 2 and a bit years as its chief executive. No reasons for his resignation have been disclosed. Rotenbach will be temporarily succeeded by Absa lifer Charles Russen. He's the third executive to act in this role and the fifth CEO overall since Maria Ramos left just 5 years ago. South Africa's inflation slowed down to just 0.4% month on month in July. That's well below expectations. Annual inflation dropped to 4.6%. Core inflation to 4.3%. This is the lowest since May 2022. The nation is mourning the passing of Dr. William Smith, a revered education pioneer and Rhodes University alumni who transformed South African education through innovative teaching methods and televised lessons. Smith established star schools and then developed educational videos that were distributed through the SABC. His basic mathematics video was rated in the UK as the best in the world in 1984. By the year 2000, his programs were reaching over 100 million viewers in 28 African countries. Rhodes Vice Chancellor Sizwe Mabizela hailed Smith as the nation's teacher. In just 4 days, Chris Steyn's interview with MK Party founder Jabulani Khumalo has been viewed by almost 500,000 people, and they spent 10 minutes per view. That's hectic engagement. Well, it features Khumalo's allegations of fraud and deceit by the Zuma family, headed by Jacob, the 82-year-old former president of South Africa.
He's been trying to be appointed on the secret documents to be the director of Umkhonto we Sizwe. I discovered this last on the 8th. There was some attempt. Then on Thursday, I discovered that yes, fraudulently, successfully put himself to be the director of Umkhonto we Sizwe. Not him alone, but his daughter Ntuzile Zuma and her other daughter Thabisile Khumalo. They are now directors of Umkhonto we Sizwe on the SIPRO. What they did, they went to SIPRO, they changed my email, they changed my cell phone so that they can receive the old OTP, then they'll be able to change my name and take me out of the SIPRO. That is the process they've been doing, and this has been happening for almost 3 or 4 months. They've been trying to do this. But finally, they fraudulently made it through getting my email changed and my cell number changed so that they can get the OTP. But when they finished, I think then they linked it back. Then SIPRO sent me the message to say that you have successfully changed, made the amendment. That's when I saw it. So that is why then yesterday I went to open the case against him, because he's the one on the SIPRO document. I can't open the case against someone that I don't know. I'm opening a case against the people that are now in the SIPRO fraudulently, because I didn't sign any document. I didn't give anyone any consent to change the directors of the SIPRO. So I'm going ahead with that case. So this will be the second case of fraud against President Jacob Zuma and his family, because he is doing this because he thinks he's the god of South Africa or of the world, I don't know. Because I don't understand an old man could do or allow this in his name. If he's a respectful person, he will say, no, not in my name. You can't do fraud in my name.
Chris Steyn asked Neil De Beer for his thoughts on what Mr. Khumalo had to say.
And we can all agree that Umkhonto we Sizwe party, the man Jabulani Khumalo, is sitting there as a spectator of death. And let me quickly tell you, Jacob Zuma murdered him. His family annihilated him. And I must tell you, listening to his interview and having spoken to him before, he's naive. He found himself in a cauldron of hyenas. And Chris, I don't think he was prepared for the major onslaught of the Zuma family and the people that was brought into the dark. I think in your interview, surely you picked that up.
And Business editor Alec Hogg asked R.W. Johnson for his insights on the subject.
Well, I wasn't too surprised by most of it, in the sense that Zuma comes out, you know, he took hold of their initiative, used it for his own purposes, and clearly had rather limited ideas about what he was going to do and has been making it up as he goes along. And, you know, MK is a fairly chaotic party. And I don't know whether that's going to change, frankly. But it is a peculiar situation.
Nicely done, team. Well, in that interview with political scientist and former Oxford Don R.W. Johnson, I gave him a follow-up question on the EFF co-founder's defection.
What are you seeing from the other big announcement of the past week, the resignation of Floyd Shivambu and from the EFF and joining MK? Again, Mr. Kamalo says it's a ruse. It's a deception. He doesn't see this as a major break. How are you reading it?
Well, of course, I know no more than anyone else, but the Sunday Times yesterday had a completely different story, which made good sense that there had been a split between Malema and Shivambu, basically over the negotiations with the GNU. And what their story made perfectly good sense to me, that Malema had been so keen to advance his own interests that he had sort of sabotaged Shivambu's negotiations. And I can see how that would be very upsetting to Shivambu. So, look, I think part of the problem is that we've now got two, radical economic transformation parties, if you like, the EFF and the MK. And I don't really think that there's room in our system for two such parties. And since MK is bigger and has got a former president leading it, it's more formidable, and it's got this large block of support in one province as well, which the EFF doesn't have. It's a more attractive pole of opposition. And I can see that it will pull people away from the EFF, and Malema's got a real problem with that. But at the end of the day, as I say, MK looks chaotic to me. They keep drafting into it more people with very shaky, dubious credentials. It's a party of crooks to a considerable extent. And it doesn't make very much sense. So I don't know whether even MK is going to hold up very well over time.
Leaving politics aside for the moment, and on to what for us at BizNews was our big event of the week, the in-studio interview with South Africa's most decorated Olympian, double gold and double silver winner, Tatiana Smith. The discussion, a must-watch, was published on BizNews TV this afternoon. That's on YouTube. As a taster, though, in this segment, the homegrown superstar explains why she took the road less traveled, rejecting foreign advances that usually athletes succumb to rather further her career with the Pretoria University swimming coach, Rocco Mehring.
I got a lot of requests from America at that time when I was going to university. Obviously, it is a very inviting opportunity because you get free education, and it just makes sense because from a financial point of view, you don't have to rely on your parents to pay. But unfortunately, or fortunately, I just never had that desire in me. I've always wanted to prove that it can happen in South Africa. And I think Rocco's heart was for it as well. So that's why I think this combo was so massive, because we both really wanted to show that even though we might not have the facilities, that we don't need it to achieve great things. And we were able to kind of proves that, I hope. There was definitely those chances, but I would never change anything in my journey, because I was true to that. It was never like I had any feeling of going to America. I never, ever, that never crossed my mind. I always wanted to stay here and go. And I think what the beauty is of Rocco is he saw me. I wasn't the best junior. I never got selected for any junior teams, South African junior teams. So I never really medaled well nationally on a junior level. But he saw that talent. He didn't hop on just when I succeeded. He hopped on from the beginning of the journey, and he just wanted me to reach my full potential. Obviously, our dream was that my full potential would be Olympics and a gold medal, and it happened. But I think that's the beauty of that, is that Rocco is someone that is always willing to learn. When we go to international competitions, you barely see him because he's always going to other coaches, finding out what have they been doing, learning and bringing his unique thing in, listening to the experience of others. But what I find very interesting is that they never ask him questions. And that's very funny because obviously I am. We have two breaststrokers in his squad that make Olympic finals twice in a row now. I've been lucky and fortunate enough to medal in that, so which means he is technically the best one of the best breaststroke coaches in the world, but no one has ever asked him anything.
And now on to the man with one of the toughest jobs in South Africa, the Minister of Public Works, Dean McPherson. Our colleague Bronwyn Nielsen conducted a fascinating interview with McPherson, asking him how he intends tackling the construction mafia, a criminal syndicate causing such devastation in the country, particularly in Dean's own home province of KwaZulu-Natal.
You know, KZN as a province, unfortunately, has a history of violence that is rooted in the political discourse of our province and of our country. And that, unfortunately, seems to have transcended into the construction space now, where we have what we would call the construction mafia bring projects to a stop. They use extortion, violence, intimidation, and all different types of tactics to effectively seek money out of construction companies in order that they can further their own interests. So it's incredibly destabilizing for our province and also for the investment climate that we need to create, because investors don't want to put their money into projects that are going to be delayed or cancelled. And it's ultimately our communities that suffer because infrastructure projects aren't being rolled out. We need to ensure that law enforcement meets these people head on. And that's why I've said there's no negotiating, because the only negotiating that we should be doing is the length of prison sentences that they should be serving for perpetuating crimes against the state, because that's actually what it is. This is state money. These are state-led projects, and we are being held hostage by a bunch of thugs and thieves. So we're very clear on what needs to take place. And I think in instances we've started to see law enforcement make their move in opposition to these people. But let's make no mistake, Bronwyn, these are not just local community members. They are highly organized, highly sophisticated, with very big guns, and they have intelligence. So it does suggest to me that these people have access to politicians, they have access to political parties, and we need to act without fear or favor and make sure that we don't just get the lowly person who's stopping the construction, but who is his boss and where the orders are coming from.
My colleague Chris Dane's Sunday afternoon chats with Neil De Beer have become the go-to source for tens of thousands of our community who seek perspective on the latest political developments. The UIM leader was on fire this week, listing the country's 10 most wanted criminals, political criminals, that is, a group that have now found common cause in their membership of the MK party.
I think one interesting fact is I'd like to read the following names: Jacob Zuma, Brian Molefe, Mandlandita, Siyabonga Gama, Floyd Chivambu, Dr. John Slope, Lucky Montana, and Mr. Money. If you had to have the 10 most unscrupulous, accused people that harmed this country on all levels of state capture, SOE collapse, and debatably the country's collapse, that's your most 10 wanted poster right there. We spent billions on the Zondo Commission, 3 years, more than 16 volumes, and those 10 names I just mentioned, some of them are sitting in Enkari. So a person has to now ask, is this going to be acceptable to Mr. X, to you and I? Is this the kind of leadership that we are just going to accept, that we are going to say is now the apex standard of leadership? And it cannot be. And that is why this canoe is going to have to get out and start saying there are certain parameters that we need sorted out before we can sit back in the next 5 years.
When I was in the US last month for a business trip, amongst the most irritating parts of the adventure was the way that everyone, and I mean everyone, expects to be tipped. I'm not the only agitated person on this. Our partners at the Financial Times took a closer look. Here's FT News Briefing host Mark Filippino and the FT's financial editor, Brooke Masters.
You may be a little confused by the way we do tipping in the United States. It might even be a little weird to some Americans, if I'm being honest. But since the pandemic, we've started expecting people to tip even more. That started to grate on customers. But it turns out any changes to the system are pretty hard to make a reality. I'm joined now by the FT's Brooke Masters to discuss. Hey, Brooke.
Hey, Mark.
All right, so you recently wrote a piece about tipping culture. For those who aren't very familiar with tipping culture in the U.S., just remind us how it works.
Basically, most services, whether it's the people who paint your nails at the salon or park your car in the garage, or most importantly, restaurants, those employees expect to be tipped. And in fact, when they think about like what they're going to live on, tips play an extremely large role. In restaurants in particular, there's a weird system where because the law allows restaurants to pay just $2 an hour to their employees, owners of restaurants have become accustomed to not including their labor costs in the menu prices. Instead, what they do is they expect their customers to make up the difference and basically pay the employees' wages in the form of tips. That's a problem because employers, they are totally reliant on tips to make their budget work. And employees, meanwhile, obviously cannot live on $2 an hour. So they, too, are incredibly vulnerable.
So this is how tipping culture kind of was before the pandemic. How and why has it changed since 2020?
Couple things happened. First of all, during the pandemic, obviously, lots of service industry businesses shut down and laid people off. There was then, when they reopened, a shortage of workers, so employers had to start thinking about how to get more money to them. And there was a sense of gratitude that these frontline workers had come back and were serving you. So the average tip climbing past 15, 18% to 22% expectation. At the same time, the pandemic meant everybody switched to contactless payments and credit cards. So now when you check out of anything, whether it's the vet or it's, you know, buying a bottle of water, they ask you, do you want a tip? And it's, you know, 10%, 15%. And these are people you never would have tipped. And so it's very in your face.
All right. So what are some of the solutions that people have proposed in order to change tipping culture?
Well, a couple things. There are high-end restaurants that actually have tried to shift to a, you know, fair hospitality price where the price on the menu specifically includes tips. There was a lot of pushback on that, and most of those experiments have failed. Another thing that some restaurants have tried is they'll put a service charge so that there is a minimum amount of money that the servers get before you have to tip. So then your tip on top is a somewhat smaller amount.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for joining us for News Wrap. Until next week, I'm Alec Hogg of BizNews.com.